Howdy ho. Welcome back to Cosigns. It's 2022. I don't know about you.
I'm not feeling 22.
It's the fourth day of 2022.
Already?
How's it going so far? Mine's been a lot of sleeping.
Yeah.
Yeah. But do you even feel like, well, I do. I do feel like 2021 existed.
Yeah, but it was terrible.
I do feel like 2020 lasted a little longer than 2021.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe that's just personal experience.
You know, everyone said that 2020 was their worst year. 2020 was great for me. 2021 was not so kind.
I mean, 2020, the last 2 years for me have really just been shitty. I can't lie. But it's not about me. Anyway, we hope that you, our listeners, and everyone had an awesome time bringing the new year with friends and loved ones, or even by yourself with your dogs or your cats or your chinchilla, whatever. You know, whoever you spent it with, we hope it was an awesome time. And hopefully you were careful about who you locked lips with at midnight. But as you know, our show is all about dating, relationships, with a little self-development thrown in there. The good, the bad, the ugly of all things love. Love can get pretty ugly sometimes. And like last season, we took a break from the typical talk of relationships and had ourselves a little true crime series. If you're new to Cosigned, let us fill you in. Last season, we did a 5-episode true crime series and brought some pretty horrific and unbelievable cases your way. And this time will be no different. So grab yourself some popcorn and your favorite drink because we're about to get into some killer couples.
Before I dive into the case I'm going to share with you guys, we're going to give you the trigger warning. So this episode deals with violent, confronting, gruesome, and triggering events that may not be suitable for all listeners. The information for this podcast episode is based off of extensive research done on cases by both of us. We at Cosign Podcast do not intend any disrespect to the victims or family members of the victims involved in these crimes. Listener discretion is advised. As if our last true crime series wasn't crazy enough, because we talked about some messed up shit.
Right.
This first case of mine has me a little bit shook. Okay. I have never heard of either of these people involved in this case, which is kind of disturbing to me simply because of how horrific it is. But just so you guys know, we're staying true to form with our true crime series this season, meaning that me and Mackenzie have no previous knowledge of each other's chosen killer couple other than their names to make sure we don't choose the same ones.
Surprise, we did.
We like to do this to make sure our reactions are just as surprised and authentic as when our listeners first listened to our episodes. So I'm super excited to see your reaction to this case.
I'm excited.
Are you ready?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
All right, so this is the story of Fred and Rosemary West. And I'm gonna start with a good old Fred.
Freddy boy.
Old Freddy. Okay, so here is the story of Fred. Fred was born in a small town in a village in England. He was the second of the 6 children of Walter West and Daisy Hill. By Fred's own account, sexual abuse of various kinds was common in the household. He claimed his father had sexual relationships with his daughters and taught him bestiality, which means sex with animals. There are a few stories about Fred that have never been confirmed or admitted to by him personally, including the stories about his father. Another is that it was suspected that Fred's mother started sexually abusing him when he was 12 years old. Fred claims that he also engaged in incest and even impregnated one of his sisters, but this was never proven to be true. Regardless, Fred and his mother were very close. When he was physically punished for doing badly in school, his mother, who was obese and often dressed unattractively, often went to his school in person to yell at the teachers for doing so. Fred left school at the age of 15, even though he was almost illiterate and had to get a job as a farmhand. When he was 16, his looks improved and he became more attractive to girls. And at the age of 17, he was in a motorcycle accident that put him in a coma for a week and led to him having a metal plate put into his head and also breaking one of his legs so badly it was permanently shorter than the other. Afterward, he developed a terrible temper and often had violent bursts of anger. 2 years after his accident, Fred hurt his head yet again when he stuck his hand up a girl's skirt and she pushed him down from a fire escape. When he was 19, he was convicted of molesting a 13-year-old girl, but he didn't serve any jail time because his doctor said he suffered from epileptic fits. Afterwards, he was sent to live with his sister and was practically disowned by the rest of his family. Fred then got a job in construction, but was fired for stealing from his workplace. When he was 21, his family let him back into their lives and he moved back to Mugmarkle in England. After moving back, he resumed a romantic relationship with an ex-girlfriend named Catherine Raina Costello, and she goes by Raina. She had been a petty thief when they first dated and had moved on to prostitution. Though Raina was already pregnant with another man's child, they decided to get married and kept the child. To explain why the baby was half Asian, Fred made Raina write to her parents that the baby had died in childbirth and that her child, a girl she named Charmaine Carroll, was adopted. They got married in November, only 2 months after getting back together and moved to Scotland. Fred demanded sex from Raina daily, and he wasn't interested in regular sex. The couple had a child of their own in July of 1964, a daughter named Anne Marie. During their rocky marriage, Fred worked as an ice cream truck driver, a job that gave him plenty of access to available young women. Their life in Scotland came to an end when Fred accidentally ran over a 4-year-old boy with his truck.
Oh my God.
Though the accident wasn't his fault, Fred moved with his family, as well as Isa McNeil, who took care of their children, and Anna McFall, a friend of Raina's, to Gloucestershire, where he got a job at a slaughterhouse. When their marriage finally collapsed, Raina went back to Scotland alone, but came back in July of 1966 because she missed her daughter, only to discover that Fred had started a relationship with her friend Anna. In 1967, Anna became pregnant with Fred's child and tried to get him to divorce Raina. In response, he killed, dismembered, and buried Anna and their unborn child. Raina finally left Fred a few months later, leaving all of their children with him. Fred is suspected to have killed again in January of 1968 when 15-year-old Mary Bassom disappeared from a bus stop. After the death of his mother in February, Fred started committing a lot of petty thefts and changed jobs a lot. It was during his time as a bakery truck driver that he met his future wife and accomplice, Rosemary Letts. Rosemary was born as Rosemary Letts in Devon, England in 1953. Her household was troubled and abusive. Her father, Bill Letts, was a schizophrenic who constantly disciplined her, her siblings, and her mother, Daisy.
They both had moms named Daisy?
Yeah.
Wow.
So while Daisy had been pregnant with Rosemary, she had received electroconvulsive therapy as a treatment for her severe depression. And if you don't know what that is, it's a procedure. It's done under a general anesthesia and basically where small electric currents are passed through the brain, intentionally triggering a brief seizure. Electroconvulsive therapy seems to cause changes in brain chemistry that can quickly reverse symptoms of certain mental health conditions.
Right. Back in the day, like back in this time period, electroshock therapy and this type of...
That's what they did.
That's what they thought would fix everything.
Yeah.
Oh, let's just shock their brain enough to where it rewires them.
Literally causing seizures.
Pretty traumatic too, by the way.
Yeah. So growing up, Rosemary was sexually abused by her father. Because she wasn't very bright and a bit overweight, she was often teased and responded by attacking her bullies aggressively. When she was a teenager, she became more sexually active and was even caught getting into bed with one of her younger brothers and molesting him. Because her body figure and her father's rules prevented her from dating boys her own age, she pursued relationships with older men where she lived, and one of them ended up taking advantage of her and raping her. When Rosemary was 15, her mother finally had had enough of her husband's abuse, so she took Rosemary and moved in with one of her adult daughters and her daughter's husband. After this, Rosemary started spending even more time with male companions. Later the same year, Rosemary surprisingly moved back in with her father. Not long afterwards, she met Fred West, who was 12 years older than her at 27 years old. Mm. She was 15 at the time. So in spite of the way he had treated her, Rosemary's father strongly objected to her dating Fred and even went to the trailer park where Fred lived with his two daughters and threatened him. Even though Fred served several terms in jail for thefts and failures to pay his fines for previous offenses, Rosemary became pregnant with his child, a little girl named Heather, and took care of his children on her own. Because of her temper problems and her resentment about caring for children who weren't hers, she often treated her stepdaughters poorly. In the summer of 1971, Rosemary apparently snapped completely and killed Charmaine, Fred's daughter, with his first wife, Raina. After cutting off his daughter's fingers and toes, he buried her under their kitchen floor. In August of 1971, Raina disappeared after she came looking for Charmaine. And because Raina's body was found to have its fingers and toes cut off when it was discovered, Fred is suspected to have been the killer. And Raina was Charmaine's mother and his first wife. Even though they married on January 29th, 1972, Fred encouraged Rosemary to have sex with other men, both for money and for fun, and often watched her through a peephole. He also took erotic photos of her and posted them in swinger magazines as ads for prostitution. In June of 1972, they had another daughter together who they named Mae West. In order to make room for their expanding family and Rosemary's business, they moved to 25 Cromwell Street, where they carried out their rapes and murders. Rosemary continued working as a prostitute from their home in a room with built-in peepholes for Fred to use and a red light outside that would be lit to tell the children not to enter. Over the following year, she gave birth to 7 more children, 3 of which were fathered by Fred. Another may have been conceived by Rosemary and her own father, who is said to have kept engaging in incest with her even after she gave birth to her 4th child. The other 3, who were of mixed race, were all fathered by her clients.
Oh my God.
Yeah. In October 1972, Fred and Rosemary hired a young woman named Caroline Owens to work for them as a nanny for their children. They kept making sexual advances on her, but she declined every single time. One night in December, after they both unsuccessfully tried to seduce her, she tried to leave only to be held captive overnight. Fred threatened to let some of his friends have her and told her that afterward he would kill her, so she complied. The next day, she was released, and even though she pressed charges, Fred was able to convince the court that the act she was forced into had been consensual, so he and Rosemary were only fined $50 for indecent assault. Over the next 6 years, they killed at least 8 young women who came to 25 Cromwell Street as lodgers or employees. The first was Linda Goh, a seamstress they both knew personally. Next was Carol Ann Cooper, who disappeared while walking home from a movie theater. In December, Lucy Catherine Partington disappeared from a bus stop while on her way home after Christmas. They abducted her, held her captive for a week over New Year, and then raped, tortured, and killed her. On January 3rd, Fred was treated for a laceration, which is believed to have been inflicted when he dismembered Lucy. From 1974 to 1979, 5 more women by the names of Therese, Shirley, Juanita, another Shirley, and Allison Chambers were also raped and dismembered as well. It's unknown if they killed more over the following years. If they did, which is definitely possible, the bodies were not buried on their property. Some of the girls are also known to have been abducted, raped, and then released. While committing murders, Fred also sexually abused Anne Marie West, his biological daughter, from his relationship with Raina. Anne Marie eventually became pregnant, and the pregnancy had to be terminated because it occurred in her fallopian tube. When she left home, he started abusing Heather West, who we know was conceived by Rosemary and could have possibly been his biological daughter. He also started abusing one of his known biological daughters, Mae West. Fred disposed of victims by burying them under the garage of the house or in the garden. To cover up the frequent burials, he pretended to be doing regular home improvement projects. In order to afford the supplies needed, he frequently stole for them. Even though he was often brought to the attention of the police because of the fake construction, his killings went unnoticed. The couple came close to being exposed in 1986 when Heather told her friends about the abuse that she was suffering. In June of 1987, Fred and Rosemary strangled Heather to death to silence her. She was then dismembered and buried in the garden. The Wests were finally exposed in May of 1992 when Fred videotaped himself raping one of his daughters. When she told her friends, one of them reported Fred and Rosemary to the police. The investigating officer, Hazel Savage, had heard of Fred while he was in relationship with Raina. When another girl raped by Fred came forward, the police obtained a search warrant. In August of 1992, they searched the house for evidence of child abuse. Fred was arrested for rape and sodomy of a minor, and Rosemary was arrested as an accomplice. While they were being processed, their younger children were placed in the care of the government. While Fred was in custody, Rosemary became depressed and even attempted suicide once, but was saved by one of her sons. Unfortunately, the rape case fell apart when the victims backed out. Meanwhile, Officer Savage became increasingly suspicious of Fred and Rosemary's past, along with the disappearance of Heather and the results of the interviews of the West children, especially after they said they had been threatened by Fred that they would be buried under the patio like Heather. She was able to obtain another search warrant to have the property dug up. The task was made simple when Fred confessed to Heather's murder while he was in custody. When human bones started showing up, Fred confessed to having committed the murders alone in order to protect Rosemary. However, he would not admit to raping any of his victims, saying that they wanted to have sex with him. Soon enough, the bodies of Ann McFall and Charmaine West turned up as well. Seeking to protect herself, Rosemary cut off all contact with her husband. On December 13th, 1994, Fred was charged with a dozen counts of murder. On New Year's Day, he hanged himself in his cell at Winston Green Prison with a knotted bedsheet. His body was cremated and his funeral unattended except for five of his children. Rosemary was also put on trial in the end, first for rape and then for murder as well. She never confessed to any murders and the evidence against her was largely circumstantial. An important witness was Janet Leach, Fred's appropriate adult, who revealed that Fred had told her that Rosemary had been involved in the murders and even killed Charmaine West and Shirley Robinson on her own. If you don't know what an appropriate adult is, it is a parent, guardian, or social worker, or if no person matching this is available, anyone responsible over 18. So on November 22nd, 1955, Rosemary was found guilty of 10 murders and sentenced to life in prison. She will never be released. Though she maintains her innocence, she announced in 2001 that she will not try to appeal her conviction. And in 1996, 25 Cromwell Street was completely demolished and the site turned into a pathway. So, the main overview of all this. In 1969, 15-year-old Rosemary met 27-year-old Fred West, and soon after, the couple got married. Not long after, the two began abducting and killing young women looking for lodging. Of at least 13 victims, three of them were their own children, and their crimes included rape, torture, kidnapping, and murder. They were apprehended in 1994, Fred West committed suicide while awaiting trial in 1995, and Rosemary West was sentenced to life in prison. The West victims were Caucasian females in their mid-teens to early 20s, and sometimes the victims were related to them. The ones who weren't were usually lured to the house under the premise that they would be hired as nannies or some other job. When the victim was under Fred and Rosemary's control, they would rape and torture her in elaborate and sadistic bondage acts for days, and then strangle or suffocate her and bury her on the property. Fred's signature was cutting off the victim's fingers and toes, and sometimes their kneecaps post-mortem before burying them. It's important to note that in addition to the above crimes, Fred is known to have committed several additional rapes in which the victims are anonymous and unnamed. He also claimed that he committed more murders. So, there was something that we did in the true crime season in season one that I really loved and I wanted to keep it going for season two. So, Mackenzie and I both agreed Criminal Minds is one of our favorite crime shows of all time, yes. And not to mention the best of all time.
That's great.
Okay.
And fall asleep to serial killers.
Right. And we had even mentioned how most of the time, a lot of those episodes from that show are somehow related to or derived from real true crime situations. Mm-hmm. Okay. So after reading this crazy case of mine about Fred and Rosemary, this is no different. I did a little digging, and I found episodes that mentioned the West, as well as episodes that had a lot of the same crimes and motives that may have been inspired by them as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do them in order. These are all Criminal Minds episodes. The main one we know is centered around Fred and Rosemary, and you're going to remember this episode. It's one of my favorites. It's season one, and it's the episode called Riding the Lightning. While not directly mentioned or referenced, the duo may have been an inspiration for the characters Jacob Dawes and Sarah Jean Mason. Both teams consisted of a dominant male who was a prolific and ephebophilic serial killer who abducted, tortured, and killed teenage girls and buried them on their properties. Mm-hmm. Ephebophilic means the primary sexual interest in mid to late adolescence, generally ages 15 to 19. Also, both teams victimize their own children in some way. And in the show, Jacob's character orders Sarah Jean to kill their son while the West killed some of their own daughters.
Right.
Another episode was season 5, and it's the episode called A Thousand Words. The West were mentioned as an example of serial killers who have children, and they may also have provided some inspiration for the criminals of the episode, Robert Burke and Juliet Monroe. Both teams were dominated by the male, and the females were accomplices to serial rape and murder committed by their lovers and were sexually abused by their fathers. Like Fred, Robert Burke also committed suicide, even though he did it before getting caught and not afterwards. And then season 13, in the episode called Believer, Fred was mentioned by Prentice as an example of serial killers who kill themselves while in custody. And then last but not least, season 14, in the episode Starter Home, the West were mentioned again.
Such a good show.
I know.
That's crazy.
And you know, it's funny nasty. Because the one with Jacob and Sarah Jean, that episode's one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah. So hope you guys don't have nightmares. Little disturbing. Literally a little piece of every crime in this one.
Yeah.
So since we dedicated an entire episode to zodiac signs and love compatibility, the Virgo and me thought that it would be fun to explore the top killer zodiac signs and all the statistics.
I feel like we've mentioned some of this before.
We have. We've talked a little bit about it. So I thought this would be fun because it kind of relates to our true crime and to our killer couple. So Astrology Zodiac Signs Today released a study on the most common zodiac signs of serial killers after analyzing 485 serial murderers responsible for killing 5,125 victims.
Some of I see something already and I don't agree with it.
After doing this huge study, right, the top four most common signs of murderers were Scorpio.
No surprise.
Shocker. Scorpio, Cancer, Sagittarius, and Pisces.
Mm.
All four of these signs had 46 serial killers each.
It has to be more than that.
Okay. Well, you have to keep in mind this is 46 known serial killers.
Right. Okay. After analyzing 485 serial murderers.
Yeah.
So out of the 485, you have 46 times these four signs.
Yes. So number two, Aquarius and Libra both had 44 serial killers each. Capricorn, 42 serial killers.
I didn't know there were any Capricorns on Earth. Just kidding.
You always say that.
Who's a Capricorn, though? Who? Like, raise your hand if you're a Capricorn. Nobody. Nobody raises their hand. Okay, go.
The next one is me, Virgo. Got 40 serial killers.
You will.
And then, of course, the next one is yo ass.
I don't believe this.
Leo with 39 serial killers. And then you got Aries, 38, and Gemini and Taurus with 27 serial killers each. And what's funny is...
This one is a... Yeah.
Yeah, so the deadliest sign, even though it's not in the top four, the deadliest sign is actually Capricorns. Because despite having the number 7 spot for the most serial killers, they killed the most people, reaching 813 victims on average of 19 victims per killer. Taurus killed the fewest with 204 victims. And then we've got the deadliest element, which still don't surprise me. These Scorpios always number one
and
for all
this shit.
And if
y'all don't know what elements are, go back to school. It's water, earth, fire, and air. Okay, go.
So the deadliest element is the water signs. Cancer, Pisces, and Scorpio.
I believe it.
Yes. And they accounted for the highest number of killers and victims combined, reaching a total of 28% of killers and 27% of victims.
I want to know, how ironic would it be if the water signs killed their victims in some form of, like, water? Used water in some form, like drowning.
See, we need to break it down even further.
Mm.
So I did a little digging and found the top serial killer to date that is known, remember, that is known of. for each sign. The first one is Cancer. The number one serial killer was Samuel Little, which I'm sure you've heard of, and he had 61 victims. Mm. Next is Aquarius with Gary Ridgway, 49 victims. Aries, we've got Donald Harvey. Oh. He had 37 known victims. Pisces is John Wayne Gacy, 33 known victims. Mm. Libra, Bill Longley, 32 known victims. Capricorn, Dean Corll, 28 victims. Sagittarius, we got good old Ted Bundy, which we did.
Teddy.
In season one, and he had 28 known victims. Scorpio, we've got Belle Gunness with 25 victims. Taurus, Earl Nelson, 22 victims. Virgo, Gerald Stano, 22 victims.
He's not an important Virgo. Mm-mm.
And Gemini, Jeffrey Dahmer, 17 victims.
I'm surprised.
And then your Leo was tied between two with Joseph Christopher and William Suff with 12 victims each.
Wow.
So Leo's the lowest on the
yeah,
list.
Yeah, baby!
Virgo and Leo are in the bottom five. Yay.
Yay.
We're back.
Okay. All I can say to your case is ew. Absolutely disgusting.
Yes.
But before I dive into my case, I wanted to list just some, a handful, scratch the surface of some of the most dangerous killer couples in history. Some of you may or may not have heard of them, but let's get into it. Number one, we've already talked about them last season, the Ken and Barbie killers. Check it out, season one, episode 22. It's gonna give you the heebie-jeebies. Number two, Bonnie and Clyde. I really wanted to do their case this episode, but I chose somebody else. Might get into Bonnie and Clyde a little later. Number three, the Moores murders. Number four, the Clear Lake Massacre. Number five, the Richardson family murders. Number six, the Twilight Killers. Number seven, the Tinder Murderer. Number eight, the Lonely Hearts Killers. Number nine, the Virgin Hunters. And number 10, the Toy Box Killers.
And you guys are going to hear some of these because when I was doing my research, I almost picked a couple of them.
And I left the names out on purpose just to tell you because we might dive into them a little later in the series. But this list goes on and on and on. But for this case I'm bringing you this week, we're going to talk about Sarah Jane and John Macon, aka the Baby Killers. Ever heard of them?
I had not heard of them until I was researching, but I didn't read much about them.
Okay.
Just saw their creepy ass pictures that you have right here.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll post this on our Instagram account.
They are scary.
They weird. Before jumping in, I just want to reiterate the trigger warning that these cases we discuss in this series are highly sensitive topics and may include murder, sexual assault, animal abuse, violence, and more. Some are distressing to not only hear about, but to talk about, so listener discretion is advised. Okay, let's start with Sarah and John and who they are. Sending their child to a baby farm was the only way single mothers could cope with financial stress during the late 17th century. Notorious baby farmers John Macon and Sarah Jane were among the worst baby killers of all time. Sarah Jane Sutcliffe was born on December 20th, 1845.
Ooh, an old case.
To Helen Murphy and Emmanuel Sutcliffe. Her father was a miller and former convict. Before meeting John, Sarah married a sailor named Charles Edwards on April 29, 1865, in Sydney, Australia. They had one daughter together. She later married John Macon on August 27, 1871. John was the son of a farmer named William Samuel Macon and his wife, Ellen Selina. So in 1871, Sarah Jane and John Macon married and went on to have 10 children together. Five sons and five daughters. Sometime in the late 1880s, in his duties as a drayman at a local brewery, John suffered an injury preventing him from performing his normal work duties. This left the Macons without any income in an impoverished state. John and Sarah became baby farmers, caring for illegitimate children in exchange for money. Basically, it was a precursor to foster care at that time. They did this to a number of infants as a source of income after John was injured in an accident at work. The only way to make it in baby farming was to be as conniving as possible. The Macons had this down pat. to prospective mothers about to give up their babies. They made promises that they could even visit their children once they were placed in loving homes. To wealthy childless couples, the Makins presented as doing the community a much-needed service and covering their costs along the way. Inside the Makin household, it was an entirely different story, that of prospering on the misfortune of others. It was not unusual for there to be up to 6 babies in the house at any given time. And this is on top of their already 10 children.
Oh my God.
Collecting around 10 shillings per week for each baby would make a fair income for the Makins. Not to mention, they continued to collect the weekly payments for the dead and buried. Sarah would also pawn the clothing of the deceased to add to their blood money income.
Wow.
Yeah. The Makins moved over 15 times in 20 years. This made it hard for the mothers to track them down. However, John would make the effort to keep his schedule and turn up like clockwork to collect money from these mothers.
Oh, I bet he was.
Mm-hmm. When they inquired about arranging a visit to see their babies, John would often make varied excuses. So let's skip to the case that started the entire investigation into this couple, because they got away with it for a long time. In 1892, 18-year-old Amber Murray placed an advertisement in the Sydney Morning Herald in search of a mother to adopt a baby boy. Amber was unable to care for her son Horace, he was 3 months old, and offered to cover child support expenses. A Mr. J. Hill, John Makin's alias, responded to Amber's advert that they were willing to take care of Horace for 10 shillings a week. Amber paid Blanche Makin, John and Sarah's daughter, one of them, an initial payment of £3, believing that she would be able to see her son at prearranged times and that he was being left with a caring, loving family. John told Amber that he and Sarah were moving out west and he would arrange a visit when they settled in 6 weeks. He still went to Amber's house weekly to collect the money, but his story meant that she wouldn't bug him to see her baby. When Amber visited the address that the Makins had originally provided, the family had moved to McDonaldtown, New South Wales, and could not be found. Amber never saw her baby alive again.
Imagine how traumatic. Because to me, it sounded like she really wanted her son, but just couldn't take care of him. And to think you're trying to do the best thing possible and you never see them again.
Right. That's so because traumatic. At this time, any child that was born to a single mother or to an unwed couple was considered illegitimate.
Yeah.
So you had to give them up. Or you got married and or disowned or whatever. The Makins often did not pay their rent. They moved once again to a town called Chippendale. The owners of the Makins' previous home cut their rental losses and began renovations. On October 11th, 1892, James Hanoni was assisting the owners with a blocked underground pipe. It wasn't long until the cause was discovered of this blockage. Wedged in tight were 2 separate bundles of baby clothing. The stench was so wretched as James pulled the material out, and the smell was that of 2 decomposing babies. He immediately called the police and the yard was thoroughly searched. They uncovered 5 more babies in various states of decomposition. Over the course of the investigation, police exhumed remains from the backyards of 11 homes that the Makins had occupied. Unfortunately, the bodies of 12 infants were recovered, even though some sources say it was 13. Prosecutors believed that the Makins sought to profit by taking in babies for child care payments and then found it easier just to kill the children and deceive the parents so they could continue receiving the money. Dr. Milford examined the bones that had been exhumed and found that each body had been wrapped in some type of blanket or cloth, which fell to pieces when handled. The doctor's opinion was that the bodies had been buried anywhere from 9 to 14 months, but the sex of the child could not be discovered. One infant was about the age of 6 months, and the other 2 months at the time of death. In all the cases, the doctor was unable to trace the cause of death, which is the most important link missing to this chain of evidence. But the theory is that the babies were killed by having their hearts or spines pierced with needles. One of the victims was Horace Murray, whose clothing was identified by his mother, Amber. When the Makins lived in Levy Street, Redfern, 12 months prior to the discovery of these infants, their neighbors allegedly told officers that a foul, offensive odor seemed to emanate from their yard. The neighbors were also confident that if the floorboards were removed inside the house, more bodies would be found. But to my knowledge, this was never done. The Makins and four of their daughters were arrested, though only John and Sarah were charged. In March of 1893, the sensational trial gained many spectators. The newspapers covered the unfolding case very closely and had runners set outside the court to get updates quickly to print. Sydney's Supreme Court was packed, with crowds overflowing and spilling into the streets. During the trial, the Makins' daughter Daisy, who was 11, and Claire Reese, who was 16, testified against them in court. Daisy recalled that when the family moved to McDonaldtown, they had with them two baby girls but no Horace Murray. Clarice testified that she recognized clothing belonging to one of the deceased infants as she had seen it in her mother's possession while that child was in their mother's care. Another couple testified that they had been paying the Makins 10 shillings per week for the temporary care of their illegitimate baby. The child died within days, and the couple then paid the Makins £2 to cover all funeral costs. The Makins did not attend the funeral, even though they were caring for this child.
Wow.
The judge that was over the trial looked at the couple in reference to baby Horace and said this: "You took money from the mother of this child. You charmed her with promises which you never meant to perform and which you never did perform, having determined on the death of the child. You deceived her as to your address and made it utterly fruitless that any search should be made. And finally, in order to make detection impossible, as you thought, having deprived it of life, you buried this child in your yard like you would a dog. You were engaged in baby farming in its worst aspect. 3 yards of houses in which you lived testify, with the ghastly evidence of these bodies, that you were carrying on this hellish business of destroying the lives of these infants for the sake of your personal gain." John and Sarah Makin were sentenced to death for the murder of Horace Murray. After 2 appeals and a plea for clemency were denied, John was hanged on August 15th, 1893. Up until he was hung, John stuck to the story that he and Sarah did not kill Horace and that they had given him to another family. Sarah had her death sentence commuted to life imprisonment at Long Bay State Reformatory for Women. After a hard campaign by her daughters, Sarah was released in 1911, having served only 19 years. She faded into obscurity and died on the 13th of September in 1918. She was buried at Rockwood Cemetery.
How the hell do you get out of prison after that?
Mm-hmm. 12 to 13.
Wow.
Babies. Mm-hmm. And ranging anywhere from 2 months to 6, 8, 9. The conclusion that I kind of want to put out there is these serial killers might not be as gruesome as Jack the Ripper or Hannibal Lecter, but they are most certainly terrifying. Targeting the old, the young, the vulnerable, while pretending to be good Samaritans, they are truly the hidden evil of society. Serial killers can look just like anybody, everyone else. They blend in seamlessly, and some can be as charming as the infamous Ted Bundy. Perhaps that's what makes them so frightening.
Well, I don't know which one of ours was worse.
I think yours might take the cake.
I don't know,
but
because
killing
babies is another realm of evil.
But imagine just what drew me in a little bit was this time period. This is basically foster care,
right?
But they called it baby farming.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I was like, baby farming. That's such a weird thing to call it. But imagine foster care. And you hear about foster care. You know these people exist still. They basically get all these children. They neglect them just to get a payment from
the
government.
Yep.
And it's disgusting.
It still goes on now. It's just called something else.
Right. And there was no DSS at the time. There's right. No, like, this was these mothers' only way to, in their mind, they're thinking, I'm giving this child
a chance,
and I'll be able to still see him or her, and when I'm better off, I can get them again.
And not only that, the moms are paying these people, and right. Their kids are dead.
Right. Imagine saying, oh, well, you can't see him, we're moving. And then 6 months later, you find out that you've been robbed blind this whole time because your child actually was pierced in the heart with a needle or in the spine with a needle.
It's disgusting. And honestly, I think the only thing that makes mine worse than yours is that my people were raping their children.
Yeah. And who knows? That could have been happening. It just was never reported. And it's 18,
it's just so weird because
It's disgusting.
It's like, this was literally purely for money. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. my two are just freaks.
Yeah.
Like, straight up.
Right.
This Both is literally business. This yours was straight business, and that makes it even more disturbing.
And we don't have children, but you don't have to have children to know that this is...
No!
Like...
Killing babies is like, literally,
like, we know where, like, they went.
Yeah. Right. All right, that is all we have for this week's episode. But if you know a crazy killer couple case that you want us to discuss, definitely send us a DM on Instagram or leave us a voice message via the link in our bio. And you already know the drill. Go follow us on Instagram.
Do it.
At co.signpodcast and click the link in our bio to rate and review us on Apple.
Yeah.
Please go do it.
We'll see you next week.
Oh my God. All right, bye guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Uh-huh.